This week on Decentralize, Dorian Nakamoto is accepting Bitcoin donations to sue Newsweek.
Bitcoin documentary, The Rise and Rise of Bitcoin, in a home theater near you.
China and Russia agree to a $20 billion currency swap, bypassing the U.S. dollar.
Sean Wilkinson is joining us today.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Rob Riddle.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
How's it going, everybody? This is Tony here on the Decentralized Podcast. First and foremost, Dorian Nakamoto, who is now accepting donations to sue Newsweek for misidentifying him as the Satoshi Nakamoto, the most interesting person around today, the new D.B. Cooper, as I like to say, and wanted to get everyone's opinions and thoughts on this, as it's pretty fascinating. And really, to me, one of the most exciting things about Bitcoin is Satoshi Nakamoto and the mystery behind it. I love cool mysteries like this, and this, you know, added another block to what already is kind of a crazy story. So what does everyone think about this?
It's definitely very interesting. I think it's worth noting that his legal fund, his lawyers are responsible for that, and they're doing it on his behalf. So I think that's worth noting. I don't think it's him directly putting up the address, but... I don't know what that means, essentially.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember Andreas actually went and met with him in person to present him with the donations that the community gave to Dorian to sort of compensate him for Newsweek's faux pas here.
Well, that's his lunch money.
Right. His free lunch, yeah. I went back and watched that video, I think it was yesterday, and it is hilarious. He's like... no question, I'm just here for my free lunch. And I'm just like, God, this guy's brilliant. Like, I love it. I don't know, man. Privacy is a fundamental human right. And if anyone who tells you otherwise that privacy is dead is just, you know, trying to get you to buy into the lie, right? I think this guy's privacy was fundamentally violated. It shouldn't have blown up the way that it did. It is an interesting topic, but not at the expense of someone's, like, directly right, their own rights, you know? And so whether it's the lawyers or him directly, I think that he has an absolute right to sue, and his life is irreversibly changed now. So
I think he has a case as well. I mean, had you know, someone then exploited this knowledge in some way, shape, or form, either, you know, trying to extort him for money or something like that. I mean, basically the idea is that, you know, Satoshi has a ton of coins. And if somebody was to go, oh, well, you know, this guy's got a bunch of coins, let's go take one of his relatives hostage and ask for him, you know, with this Bitcoin that he has.
Yeah.
And as it'd be even, you know, it's even worse if, you know, he's not the guy. Well, there's no way he can pay them. And it's basically this poor guy now has to put up with this.
Yeah.
Basically lost by Newsweek.
I think that the worst part of it all is the way that Newsweek originally framed the article, saying, like, really directly implying that he was Satoshi. Now, indefinitely for the future, there's going to be some core group of people who maybe think that he still is.
Yeah.
And you can't take that back, right? That's just flat out irresponsible journalism, in my opinion. And it's absurd. Newsweek should fully compensate him for all in future damages.
Well, you're assuming the rest of journalism is responsible.
What do you mean? Like, because it seems to me that this was, you know, Newsweek's gimmick to get back on the newsstands because they were coming back as a print magazine because of this story. Well, because of the story, but using this as, like, their relaunch, you know?
Yeah,
and they're the ones that are clearly at fault here. And, you know, the fact that everyone bought into it so much really tells you a lot. And another story, not, you know, involving anything close to this, but I find interesting like this, is when the guy, there was some guy that ate some guy's face, and everyone blamed bath salts. Well, it turns out after there was actually, you know, a drug test given, the guy that did this was not on bath salts at all. In fact, I don't think he was on any illegal substance of note. And no one reported that, though. They only reported that some crazy guy that's thought to be on bath salts, you know, did this hideous crime. And this is like this, you know, this story came out, it turned out to be untrue, but, you know, a lot of people, I think, missed that part where it's untrue. So they're going on their day-to-day lives thinking this is the guy because, you know, to be fair, the evidence was pretty strong. I see why they thought that, but, you know, it does lack professionalism. It lacks them coming out and saying, hey, you know, this is why we messed up. And you know, I think journalism is so important, really, really important. And, you know, the internet has it's been a double-edged sword for journalism because it's made it tougher to monetize it, but it's also made it easier for anyone to do reporting. The problem is that also makes it easier for anyone to lie or change a story easily. So you really, you know, it's just like it has always been. You question the sources and who's speaking on it. And I do feel bad for Dorian here, because it really does seem where, you know, he just kind of got blindsided by this. But if you do read it, there's so many little interesting little intricacies. It's almost like the JFK conspiracies. Like, there's so many little things that are weird, you know, and like how he lived near, I believe, Hal Finney, and how, you know, just a lot of little things are odd about all this. Still fascinating, though, and really interesting. Here, I think this is a good moment. Does anyone else have great theories of who Satoshi is? These, by the way, these are completely theories, but does anyone have any interesting ones?
Oh, well, I mean, there's several possibilities. There's A, he's hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
I think that's one good possibility. Two, that, and this is the one that I mostly believe, is that he essentially worked for some kind of government agency. So he's using maybe proprietary information or stuff that could really get him in trouble and get locked away in some prison for a very long time. So obviously he can't be public about that. Three, he could be working on the next big Bitcoin thing. So I think those are some possible ideas. But in terms of that, I mean, some of the most prevailing things that he might be hiding in plain sight and we just don't know it.
I mean, I'm under the impression that it may not be just one person, that it's multiple people, like a research team, like a bunch of buddies that could have, you know, worked at a government agency, and they were like thinking about this in their spare time, and they're like, there's no way we can tell anybody about this.
Right.
But if we had a pseudonym and then we just did it, and they would think it's one person, you know, just kind of go out on that limb. And if I'm remembering correctly, like, there's different written styles between like his posts and the white paper and things like that, which seem to imply that a little bit.
Yeah. I want to be clear about my opinion on this. I don't think who Satoshi is matters ultimately. I think it's the idea that matters. And this idea of decentralization is that we all have an equal stake in this sort of like shared idea, and that no one can take that from anyone. You can't arrest this idea. You can't, you know, murder this idea.
It's kind of like V for Vendetta, right?
No, it totally is. Right. And that's, I mean, obviously that's kind of why, like, you know, Anonymous and 4chan sort of identified with the V for Vendetta, right, and the symbolism there and the mask and all of that. But as far as my direct theories, and again, I don't really like speculating about this, but I'm fairly convinced that this was an academic. Now, whether they were employed by a government, or maybe even a university, I would lean towards the university. This is far too disruptive of a change for a CIA or a NSA to sort of like put out in the wild against its own existence. So I would rule out a government here. I would suggest that it's an academic, and I would suggest that it's a single academic. And I would suggest that they did this in sort of collaboration. They shared their ideas over the course of two years, roughly, with some close friends, perhaps at other universities, got sought feedback on the ideas, built on an existing body of work, you know, Adam Back and a lot of the previous work, Nick Szabo, and some like the, you know, Hashcash and some of the previous work that has been done. And I think ultimately they worked through as much of the ideas they could. They got themselves to a minimum viable product, and they pushed it out the door. And then when he realized that the idea was actually taking wind, it was gaining some wind underneath its wings and was taking off, he recognized that his idea was actually working. And he sort of like backed away from the limelight. Yeah. And again, let me point out the time at which Satoshi disappeared. It's when Gavin posted on Bitcoin Talk forums that he had agreed to go speak to the CIA, right? So when the CIA invited Gavin to go speak, and one of the last emails I think that Gavin sent to Satoshi was, "Hey, I'm just letting you know I've agreed to do this. I think that, and I think Gavin is right still to this day, that transparency and openness is the answer here. We can't be doing things in the dark, or, you know, be too, you know, subversive about this. I mean, the technology itself speaks for the subversiveness of what's happening here. You don't have to like necessarily hide from the government for the technology to disrupt the government. The states will fall. We don't have to hide from that, right? There's no shame and no reason for us to avoid that. So I think that Satoshi is sitting in the wings right now, just watching the chaos unfold as the states collapse.
I think one of the names that you brought up is someone that I like to mention a lot. And I don't know or anything who he is, of course, but I recommend his blog to a ridiculous degree, and that's Nick Szabo. His blog is unenumerated.blogspot.com. And if you are interested in different subjects, and by that I mean very different, he talks about all kinds of different things in here. And it's absolutely fascinating the kind of knowledge this guy has. And I don't know if he has anything to do with, you know, Bitcoin and Satoshi or not. But when you mention his name, as soon as I heard him in talks when all you hear all this Satoshi theories, I started reading his blog and became absolutely fascinated by it. So that's more of a recommendation to the people that are listening to this podcast of, you know, the kind of thinking that actually is happening on the internet. And it's not happening on Huffington Post. It's not happening on, you know, the large websites that, you know, may dominate most of the top Reddit, default subreddits. But, you know, it's really happening on these little blogs that are giving people a really cool platform to get their thoughts out there. And on weird topics, different topics, but everything that he has written is really well thought out, and I can't recommend it enough. And I really wish there was a more – this is a terrible thing to say on a podcast called Decentralized, but I do wish there was some kind of centralized repository for blogs like this where they're not – you know, they're academic in nature, as in you will learn when you read them, but they're outside of the traditional academic system, so you're getting different viewpoints that aren't a part of that system. So I think that I do share that feeling that it is an academic, and it probably does have ties to a university somewhere here in the States, but, you know, you don't know. And I think when you were saying earlier, Eric, about how it doesn't matter who Satoshi is, I think ideally you're right, but I think practically and realistically you're not. And the reasoning is that's one of the most fascinating things about Bitcoin to people that are just coming in, right, is people want to know, okay, who made this, right? Because people know who invented a certain item, or they know that someone invented it. You know, this is one of the few things where, you know, it's happening now, and no one is claiming credit for it. And I understand why, because, you know, who was it? The Eagle people, I think it was, that ended up getting, you know, I think it was a pretty hefty charge against them. I don't know if they ever served time. Don't quote me on this. This is just something that's happened, I think, in the past decade. But, you know, if you create a competing currency, the government will go after you. So there's many reasons why this guy's, you know, or woman or group are staying underground, but it's also one of the most fascinating parts of the story. And whenever there's a mystery like this, it gets everyone's minds going, you know, and that's why I say he's the D.B. Cooper of now. And I'm not sure if you all are familiar with D.B. Cooper, but he was this guy in the 70s that was on an airplane, basically hijacked the plane for $100,000 ransom, took the $100,000, parachuted out of the plane, and no one has really heard of him since. Never identified. The only thing they ever found was like some of the dollar bills or some of the 20s or 100s that were, you know, found somewhere over the Pacific Northwest. And they made a movie about him, and it was one of those really well-known, you know, well-known mysteries, like, you know, Amelia Earhart. People love mysteries. So I think that's very important when it comes to the narrative of what people are talking about when they talk about Bitcoin. But I think that the fact that that narrative is so interesting is also helping people get into Bitcoin, and it's helping things like these movements, like, you know, Fire Chat, and it's creating, you know, a different mindset of how people communicate. So I think that's definitely a good thing as well.
Yeah, so when you talk about having a centralized source for this information, it doesn't have to be centralized, right? Like,
you're right.
It can be stored on a
one-stop shop.
Yeah, it can be stored on a decentralized stratum, right? Like Storge. And we're really glad to be joined today by Sean Wilkinson of Storge.io. So I think that having a centralized entity, there was even a post on Reddit today about maybe, or I think it was maybe yesterday, about having a decentralized search engine. This is another one of those harder computer science problems that will fall in the face of the intellect that's being attracted by Bitcoin and the overall crypto ecosystem. So these systems are coming, right? But you don't have to necessarily put it on the spectrum of centralized versus decentralized and lean towards centralized just because you need a source. If you do want one, if you want to take my idealism and take it to praxis, I would recommend the Nakamoto Institute. The guys over there do fantastic work. They aggregate a lot of these papers, provide commentary and context for everything, and really describe it in a way that is not only understandable to sort of the layman, but has the depth and accessibility of knowledge that I think everyone is looking for as they dive deeper into this rabbit hole of decentralization.
And it really is a rabbit hole. And, you know, the rabbit hole, I think, is well documented in a new movie that's coming out, which I did want to talk about. I should say is out now, The Rise and Rise of Bitcoin, which as of right now is number two on a fruit-based chart. There's a company that produces items, and they're named after fruit, and they also sell media. And they're number two, so we're hoping it gets to number one on this chart. Not that it means anything, but it does mean that they have more sales. And I did get a chance to watch The Rise and Rise of Bitcoin. Highly recommended. I can't wait to actually watch it again because I want to sit down and give it my 100% undivided attention because I had it on when I was doing stuff around the house. I thought that it documented what has happened so far really well. I read a few of the mainstream press's reviews of it, and some were overly political. To me, you know, a documentary should really take all your personal beliefs out of it and should be judged as, does this tell this story well? And I thought it told the story pretty well. I don't think it was perfect. I don't think it was perfect at all. There were some things I would have liked to have seen in there that I didn't see. But I thought overall it was pretty damn good. And I wanted to get everyone's opinion on here who has seen it, what they thought, and what maybe they thought could be improved, or what do they think, you know, should have been included that wasn't.
Yeah, I loved The Rise and Rise of Bitcoin. And I loved it so much that I've put together a showing for tomorrow night. I'm having as many people as possible sort of watch this film. I think it's fantastic. It does a good job of staying somewhat neutral and just describing the story. And it goes from, you know, where Bitcoin was in the early days and where it got to as of about, you know, 3-4 months ago even. And I would strongly I'm trying to recommend this film to everybody that I know. I'm giving it to my family. I would encourage you to purchase it, but it is also available. I don't even know if it's legally or not legally, whether that's even the appropriate term here, because I don't know how they actually chose to publish it. But it's available on Torrents. Get it however you can, and I encourage you to donate or pay for it on their website because this film is fantastic. I love it.
Yeah, it's on BitcoinDoc.com, by the way. Has anyone else here in studio checked it out?
Yeah, I saw it, I think, for the first time at the Chicago conference a little bit ago. So it's great. I highly recommend it as well. And I'm curious what some of the other people outside of Bitcoin who have really no exposure to Bitcoin at all watching that movie, and I'm curious to see some of their reactions to it.
Yeah, I think that's really critical here. So the Bitcoin community already has sort of like this, you know, this cult feeling to it, right? Like everybody outside.
They watch a Bitcoin cooking show.
Right, exactly. So some comments on Reddit and like some other places and some of the things I've talked to my friends about is like it is really important for people outside of the Bitcoin community to see this film. We all, for the most part, know the story, right? Mm-hmm. We know how Bitcoin got started. We know how it happened. I think everybody needs to share this with people outside of the Bitcoin community just because it gives an accurate perspective of what's happening and how this happened. So
what I'm really hoping is that the creators, after, you know, the immediate commercial cycle is over, just put this on YouTube for free for people to watch, because I think, you know, after they monetize it and, you know, sell the Blu-ray and sell the deluxe versions, and, you know, I'm thinking maybe in a month or two, putting this up for free education, it would be invaluable. And, you know, it's one of those things where there are decentralized networks to even do hosting. This could be something that could be on Torrent for free. And, you know, what I did was I ended up tipping for it, and I purchased it that way. And then I actually purchased it through the official website because I got it the other way first. And I liked it. And I'm a firm believer of try before you buy. I'm not going to buy a car before taking it around,
yeah,
you know, doing a test drive. And I love the movie, so I was like, okay, they deserve my money. In fact, they deserve it twice. So
yeah.
I was, like the image says, giving me my money. But I do think that for the ultimate educational tool, you know, it would be great to get it on Netflix. And it would be great to also get it on Snag Films, which specializes in documentaries, and
yeah,
it's free. And getting it on YouTube so that, you know, I can send it to my mom easily because she's not going to be able to purchase it. She just doesn't know how. On Amazon, but if it's, you know, a DVD where I could send it to her and burn it for her or something like that, I could make it happen. Or
yeah,
if it's on YouTube even, So I think that's an important goal, too, that I hope the filmmakers are considering.
Agreed. I'm curious, because we made the decision, I think last week was or the week before maybe, was the time we decided to release each of our podcasts as streamable torrents. And maybe this is because I believe ideas are very abundant, and subsequently it's execution that matters. I'm curious, why did they make the decision to not release this on torrent? Are they looking to get compensated specifically, or are they looking to spread the message? I don't know, but I think this would be this is like an ideal case and a really missed opportunity for the filmmaker to sort of pioneer a new way of publishing a film. So imagine if they had, you know, the preferred distribution method was a streamable torrent, right, where the MP3 or the MP4 was wrapped directly in a torrent file. And then maybe they pioneered a way to use Bitcoin payment channels to stream it live, or maybe not, and just make it freely available, right? Like,
yeah.
I think they missed an opportunity here. And I hope to see, you know, more filmmakers sort of explore these options down the road now that we have these tools available to us.
Mm-hmm. Especially with Tom York's success with the BitTorrent bundle, you know, that was something where there was a paywall, but, you know, it used the technology.
Yeah,
to distribute it.
How successful was that? Do we have any idea on the numbers?
We do, but we don't. The only thing, unless they released something in the past couple of days, which now I'm looking on, the best that they had were download numbers, which of course does not mean purchase numbers.
Right.
It just means people that have downloaded, you know, the torrent file itself and didn't necessarily purchase it. So I don't have purchasing numbers on that, but I'm going to give it another look because I am curious to see. I do know that a few years ago, Saul Williams did something similar. And, you know, BitTorrent was one of the distribution methods, and it didn't do as well as he hoped. I do know that. I would really hope that, you know, those out there that are really supportive of these things, that, you know, get rid of gatekeepers, that are really decentralized ways to distribute art, we're putting their money where their mouth is. And, in fact, I would actually say I would feel better if someone's supporting indie artists rather than the big name ones on here, because, you know, they're the ones that need the $5 to compensate for their records so they can make a new record, you know, so they can buy new equipment. And I think that, you know, it's important for those to put their money where their mouth is here. And I'm not saying you need to spend, you know, donate $20, but donate a buck or two if there's a Bitcoin address, you know. Help out some way, in some minor way. And with Bitcoin, it's easy to donate 50 cents or a dollar. You don't have to be spending 20 bucks here. But to support artists that are really going out of their way to, you know, support movements like this, I think that's super important.
Yeah, agreed. So something that's actually been really interesting to me lately is, you know, sort of South America and a lot of these other countries have been having some serious government mismanagement issues, especially with their finance and their currency systems. Up recently, the Venezuelan default is imminent. There is a lot of people saying that it is absolutely going to happen, where the government is defaulting on their debt, which is, you know, a huge problem for an economy, right? And I've been noticing the citizens are pretty much flocking to Bitcoin. There's some really interesting numbers out from a couple of the wallet companies and the exchanges showing just the massive influx from Venezuela. Riddle, what do you make of that?
I mean, with the currency controls that are in place there, really the only way that they're going to get around them right now is via Bitcoin. I mean, there's a large issue of Venezuela being able to just levy their bank accounts very easily, and they have to compete with Bitcoin's price or value relative to their own currency. I mean, if their currency is falling 30% year over year, Bitcoin just has to beat that, and suddenly it's a better currency, relatively speaking. And you know, it's just going to take it. I mean, people are, if you allow the market to control it, people are going to go to the thing that gives them the best value for, you know, their time and effort.
So do you think that state currencies can compete with Bitcoin?
They can in the short term, specifically because there's a stigma that, you know, there's nothing backing Bitcoin and therefore it's scary. I think the longer and longer Bitcoin goes on, that scariness goes away. And so you have less people afraid to try it or actually store their value in it. Right now you have people who are kind of on the fence who, you know, they keep most of their value in US dollar, but they still have their investment in Bitcoin. While, you know, you're already starting to see some people who actually take all of their, you know, have all of their net worth in Bitcoin at this point and have very little fiat. So I think you're going to start to see that transition a little more, especially with some tools coming out now to allow people to get do payroll in Bitcoin and things like that. That makes it easier for the average company to do that if their employees choose. But yeah, I mean, I think it's all about time,
yeah,
more than anything else.
So you raise a really interesting thing there, like 30% year-over-year inflation, right? Like for a lot of these countries.
Yeah.
I mean, in the U.S., this isn't a big deal because we only suffer from what, 3 or 4% inflation, which sucks, right? And we've lost 98% of the value of the U.S. dollar over the past 100 years, right? Which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I mean, Bitcoin last year at this time, it's what, October 14th. Bitcoin last year at this time was a little over $100, like $140. Today it trades at $407.1 right at this moment. So we've already seen like a 3x improvement, a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive. I think it's really difficult for a state to compete with that.
And it's kind of surprising that it's able to keep that value given that, you know, new Bitcoin's created hourly,
maybe
10-minutely.
Well, I think it's also worth noting that they're strong and weak fiat currencies. So you have a place like Argentina or any of these other portions where the fiat currency is quite weak and there's a lot of inflation. So Bitcoin seems like a good option for these particular places. And so there's a particular growth idea for Bitcoin that Bitcoin doesn't essentially take on the U.S. dollar. But it gobbles up these other smaller currencies that have these huge inflation rates to a point where Bitcoin takes over all the small markets, so it's essentially larger than the dollar or some of these other fiat currencies just because it ate up all the emerging markets because their currency system just wasn't working at all.
Right. Interesting. So sort of pursuant to all of this is the recent news of an agreement between China and Russia to bypass the U.S. dollar and just do a direct currency swap between the Chinese yuan and the Russian ruble. Now, this is a $20 billion deal, which is no small sum, mind you. But I think it's somewhat marginal. And I have no idea about the Russian or Chinese economies and what their scales are, but I imagine $20 billion currency swap is fairly small in comparison to their national economies.
Sounds like they're just kind of putting their foot in the water and kind of testing it out.
I would make a different analogy. Rather than putting their foot in the water, I think they're taking a sharp stick and poking a bear. granted, it's a starving bear, maybe, you know, hibernating or something. I don't know, but like they're just basically saying throwing sand in the face of the United States is what I think this is much more of a political statement saying, hey, you know, the U.S. dollar is not, you know, where we want to be. We're trying to decouple from it. So
yeah,
absolutely. And I think one of the points that is actually came out with that was that they had there was a meeting, you know, I should say multiple meetings between China and Russia, and there were 40 other agreements signed between them. You know, and I think one of them that was highlighted was another pipeline from Russia to China. So I think with those being, you know, a part of it as well, I really wish that I had a list of all 40 in front of me just because I'm curious, you know, to see what the others were. But this clearly seems like a giant middle finger to the United States. I don't really see, you know, that changing. But I do know that China, you know, now the yuan is basically the number one you know, a part of the number one economy in the world. China took over from the United States, I believe. I read this last week sometime. So I think that's interesting as well. And, you know, we need to pay attention to this kind of stuff just for the simple fact that, you know, regardless of what currency you're rooting for, which seems weird to me, like their teams, but, you know, things are happening right now that are really not great if you're an American citizen and you're looking at our GDP and how, you know, we're handling our own business here. And I think that it really, you see things like Bitcoin and these great technologies and these innovations happening and solar energy and how there are legacy, you know, industries that are pouring so much money and funds into this that you now have politicians coming out saying, you know, coal made America great. It's like, well, you know, that's ridiculous too. That's a ridiculous statement. There could be better ways and there are better ways. So I think that it's just another example of that, and how, you know, I think as a nation and as really the world in the coming years, it's going to be more global, needs to pay a little more attention to, you know, what's coming up, what's coming and happening in 5 or 10 years that's going to be better.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you raise a valid point. I mean, it just sort of it underscores the importance of decoupling individual liberties and finances from whatever particular geographical nation you are presently residing in. My financial freedom should not be dependent on the current political situation of my country of residence. I don't believe that the United States, you know, as much of a patriot as I might consider myself to be, right? Like, I may love where I live, but I absolutely despise the government, and that's left and right. And I think that I do not want to put my trust and faith in the U.S. government in this case, let alone any other government. I want to have full and true independence from that, so that I can elect myself into a system that I believe in, and take my finances and financial well-being with me.
Absolutely. See, I don't despise the government. I despise inefficient processes and systems, which means that, you know, the government isn't exactly acing that test.
Well, the government is by design inefficient and slow, as not to bend to the whim of the people, but to bend to the will of the people. If the government was agile like a startup, we would be wavering all over the place as public opinion, you know, preferred Oprah over, you know, Tyra Banks or something, right? Like, this would be, if the government was not slow by design, then we would be living in an even worse world, right? But I think the ultimate answer here is to simply eliminate governments entirely and let everything be voluntary and let people opt into systems that they believe in, so that the free market can determine which systems win and which systems do not, so that there's not a centralized power structure within these systems.
I think eventually that will happen, but I think we're more than a few decades away from that even being a feasible solution. For one thing, I don't think humanity is ready for that. People are too busy. You know, people kind of, in some weird way, most people enjoy being told what to do because it's one less thing they need to worry about.
Yeah, I think so. That's because they've been trained to do that, right?
Yes,
like it's been it's ridiculous. And sort of pursuant to this, right? Like, is sort of in support of what you think is we're not ready for it? Is this BitNation thing, right? So BitNation is an aggregation of services and people and blockchains that aim to create a truly digital state, one that is completely independent of geographical boundaries. And I think it's a completely noble cause. I don't think it's too soon for it. But this recent explosion of BitNation, where some of the core developers who've been working on these ideas and this infrastructure to support such an idea have resigned just prior to the crowd sale going live. And has anybody read any of the details on what their reasoning was? I find it completely fascinating that this idea is like being put out there and people are actually doing it right now. Obviously the road is bumpy, but does anybody know anything about this?
The interesting thing about that is like they were just about to start their crowdfunding, and then just before or after it might have started, I'm not sure, the entire dev team just went, nope, we don't want to be a part of this. So I haven't done too much reading into it, but apparently they had some misgivings about actually being a part of this project once it started raising some money.
Yeah, I wonder if it's sort of like all power, sort of like, or anytime you're like forming an idea and you're have an initiative of some sort, there's naturally sort of like this attraction to acquiring a little bit of power so that you can affect the change you're looking for. And it's sort of a push and a pull, right? Like you have to sort of weigh what your objective is with your idealism and your pragmatism. And you have to balance like, well, you know, if I'm going to affect the change I want, how do I accrue enough energy and momentum to make this happen? And I wonder if that's the reason why this is starting to fall apart. I can go ahead and say that this probably is not the first and definitely will not be the last attempt at something like this. And I do wish both the people who have left BitNation and the people who are still there the best. And I think we should do a little bit more reading into this to see, you know, where this is going to go.
Well, I do. What I did read so far is that one of the members informed them that most of the core development team were resigning, and they were citing moral and legal concerns about how BitNation is run. I think that's it. I think it's the same reason when we were talking about Satoshi Nakamoto earlier. When you're doing something that grand and that, I don't know, revolutionary, what you're also doing is you're starting to wake up a sleeping giant, you know? And that's why I think this, you know, I don't think now's the time to try to be replacing the government. I think things like Bitcoin are what's essential. Is we need to take specific items where this technology can be utilized, perfect that utility. Then you can do this one by one, and while things are slowly changing, you'll see a different mindset toward this kind of technology. And that's why I say I don't think people are ready, and I don't necessarily think governments would let this occur under their nose without a lot of blowback. So I think that's why they saw that writing on the wall, and they said, hey, you know, if we go through with this, we're going to be attracting a lot of heat on ourselves. Is this something we want right now? And they kind of thought about it, and they went, no, probably not, and they backed off, you know. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of idealism in what a decentralized society can bring, and believe me, I love that. But I also live in the real world where we're in a certain society now that we need to exist in, and I think that the first uses of decentralized technology need to be perfected before, you know, discussion of grander scale things of that nature occur. You know, we still are in a society where you can't vote for president online. You know, there's still a lot of ways that we're lacking here. And I think that if I was a member of that, or if I had anything to do with that project, that would be the reason that I would reject it. I'm not interested, yeah, you know, in bringing that kind of heat on myself.
Yeah, I mean, you got to realize the inability to vote digitally is largely in effect only in the U.S. Like, the U.S. is so far behind other nations in this capacity. Like, I think the Shining Beacon, as an example of a centralized state that is doing things very interestingly, is one that is governed by a president who was a computer engineer before being elected president. And that country, every single citizen is issued a digital identity. They have the ability to vote digitally. Their entire system, in fact, like every single thing by government mandate, is digital and starts from digital first rather than converting, you know, old legacy processes into a digital system. They started very cleanly and have implemented a truly digital system, and the citizens are loving it, right? The U.S., on the other hand, is so far behind any of these things. It's at the bottom of the ladder. It's at the bottom of the ladder. We have among the worst high-speed internet among high-speed internet-enabled countries, and I do believe internet access is also a fundamental human right.
Absolutely.
We're at the bottom of the list in terms of internet access. We're at the bottom of the list in terms of government transparency. We're at the bottom of the list in terms of, like, interference with other governments. We're at the bottom of the list in terms of citizen happiness. Like, we talk about the United States – a lot of people talk about the United States being such a great nation. But the fact of the matter is we have become completely complacent about the idealism and the beliefs that we are supposed to have as a people. And as a result, the United States – and many other countries as well, not just singling out the United States, have completely lost through this complacency and sort of like buy-in to sort of just like this general happiness rather than making sure you hold true to your beliefs and ideals and standing up for those and standing up and doing taking action and speaking out when things are not following those ideals.
And this topic completely lit a fire under my ass, and I'll tell you why. Is anyone here familiar with the Arrow TV case that happened earlier this year?
Oh, is that where they had this little device that would pull in the airwaves, and then they got sued into oblivion because
and
of the licensing concerns?
Basically, what it did was, yeah, it would rebroadcast over-the-air signals over the internet. It's like a streaming service, so you could like stream your local channels. And what they would do is they bought a bunch of over-the-air antennas and restreamed it. And, you know, the, you know, big telecom and all the companies that own, you know, the television stations weren't having that. Well, this went to the Supreme Court. And if you read some of the statements they said, one of them referred to it as Netflix as a service. And if you read it, you kind of see some of the analogies they're making. And then you realize these people are 60 to – I think – what's the youngest? Sotomayor, I think, is like 53. These people are – that's the youngest. Everyone else, some of them are in their 80s. Like, and they're making judgments on the technology that we're living with now, and that future generations will be making judgments on what they're saying about this. And – it's just so disturbing to me.
Yeah.
And I think it's a part of this mindset that older is wiser. No, wise is wiser. You know, like whoever knows more about a subject is wiser. And it bothers me that the people that are elected in this country are the first people that are saying, bring out the geeks. Really? Because guess what, motherfucker? I would expect you to be a geek if you're holding office. Because guess what? That's how the world works now. That's how people communicate. That's like saying, hey, I don't know how to use mail. And you're an elected politician or you're a judge.
Well,
I
totally agree. Look at the composition of your government, right? Look at the composition of the majority of governments around the world. The composition is largely lawyers, right?
And
what do lawyers know about technology? I did some work in the IT services business, and some of our customers were lawyers, and we would go into those offices, and they were completely clueless. They barely even knew how to turn the machine on, let alone how to operate or manage information flow. So the case about that device, that sounds like that thing is just simply a transmission converter, right? That's like saying that it is against the law to convert from HTTP into HTTPS, right? Like, are you kidding me? Like, this is ridiculous. Like, what we need to be doing for our government is rather than electing lawyers, or at least, like, have some fair composition based on bring technologists in, bring engineers of all sorts in, bring scientists in, and let your government be composed of people who are actually subject matter experts rather than experts on one subject field. No wonder your government is inefficient and incapable of governing its people. It's because it's composed of lawyers whose sole job it is to obfuscate the law and make it ununderstandable so that the people can't understand it and subsequently require them to be paid to understand and interpret the law. I think it's absolutely absurd. And any centralized government ultimately leads to the same model. We've seen it before in history. We've seen it in every government, every empire that has existed, and this empire too will fall.
I wonder what it will fall to is my thing, and I don't know. And I think that it's dangerous to speak on in one way, but it's also not, because it's something where there's a lot of presumptions that people had about how people communicate, how things are done, that have changed. And, you know, and I mentioned this in a previous episode. To me, the fact that one of the first skills taught to kids isn't how to properly Google something is just ridiculous. That is, you know, learning very basic Boolean logic and terms to accurately search things, basic stuff here, is essential. And, you know, no one's teaching that. And then when you see that, you realize how unprepared we are for what's going to happen. You know, and when I tell folks, I'm like, hey, you know, the video game that your kid's playing just possibly may be better training for future jobs than sitting in a classroom learning, you know, whatever is in that book. Because, you know, those drones are going to need operators, even if they're delivering something for the short term, they will at least. And, you know, little things like that where just misplaced priorities throughout society that actually is not preparing for the future, and it's blind. And, you know, when you have Supreme Court justices that don't care to learn this and they're stuck in their ways and they're in there for life, you know, sometimes you need to look at the system and go, okay, what's not working here? Let's see what's not working. And I think one of the things that isn't working is this glacial pace of change throughout everything in the government, where some things need to have very slow change, others need to have very rapid change. And it's about time that they realize that. And I think educational institutions in general need to feel that way and get with it a little more. And, you know, it really is sad that we're still clinging on to very old curriculum recommendations that were recommended by Microsoft and that involve studying Microsoft products. Like, you know, I read something about that recently and I thought it was kind of funny because it was very true. That's what computers mean to a lot of people, is learning Office. And it's sad, you know, it's really sad. And that's what gets me fired up a lot. And it's something that people need to talk more about, because it's easy to get caught up on these hot button issues like abortion, same-sex marriage, you know, hot button issues, but really things that, you know, aren't necessarily preparing the next generation to be economically, you know, a part of society. And that is freaks me out a little bit, that the priorities are that misplaced.
Yep. Do not trust anyone over the age of 25.
I agree. I'm 30, and you shouldn't trust me, man. You should just be ignoring everything I'm saying, because I feel myself becoming less vital and less clued in by the day, and it depresses the hell out of me, and I'm trying everything to do to fight that. And I wish there was like a youth serum I could take. But, you know, I hear you. Like, I think that the great ideas happen at a certain age. And I think the brain's ripe at that age for revolutionary things to happen. I'm not saying that older folks can't, you know, contribute, and they have, and they, cause they've made great, you know, great contributions to society throughout history. But you'll notice there's a certain age where the mind is just exploding with ideas, and, you know, to harness that's, is really for the benefit of everyone. And it makes me sad to see that so many young people are getting so screwed by an economy that really is, you know, full of just absolutely terrible stereotypes about how millennials work this way that have existed throughout time, don't get me wrong. But when you see it, you just go like, really? Because some of these, yeah, some of them are slackers. Some of them aren't, you know, going to do anything. But some of them may have some of the best ideas. And if you're just ignoring them, you're putting yourself at a massive disadvantage. So I actually agree a lot with what you're saying. And I have to say, since I just recently turned that big 30, it's awkward because I feel that way completely now more than ever. And the older I get, the more, and maybe this is because I'm getting older, the more that cements that belief that, you know, young and vital usually provides some of the best ideas.
Yep. All right. So last segment, I want to talk really quickly about something we missed over the past couple weeks. Is Patrick Byrne's announcement with Overstock.com that they'll be working together with the Counterparty team to build a new, well, a replacement for the stock market and an equity trading platform. Sean, what are your thoughts on that?
So, yeah, this is a fairly interesting announcement, seeing as that StorageCoin, our Counterparty asset, is the second largest Counterparty asset, and it's kind of one of the foundations for our platform. But all in all, it's very, very positive in terms of taking Bitcoin technology and use cases into the traditional sector and replacing things like Wall Street. I think one of the major points you can make is looking at the NASDAQ. A couple months ago had some technical issues and went down. And so you put a huge halt on the world economy and the traders who need to do this stuff to make that work. So in terms of building out a more decentralized solution, a solution that works without central controls and, again, doesn't just break and go down, I think is a lot better, minus the all political points and whatnot. It's just technically more feasible and better to use.
Well, from a political standpoint, I mean, what do we expect to see from, like, regulation on this? I mean, it seems like the U.S. likes to jump on regulation anytime anything Bitcoin comes up. Do you guys think it's going to fly, or what do you guys think?
I think the thing is worth noting that it's Overstock. So it's not like a little, you know, tiny boy going up against, you know, these regulators. This is a major, large company that has a lot of connections. So they're going to be doing, you know, their work and their due diligence. So at least there's, you know, something to go up against. But there's definitely going to be some questions, and there's definitely probably going to be some pushback and some blowback. But I don't know. It's really this open-ended question. Is the regulators are going to try to just shut this down, or... Well, you know, they make a good bit of progress, and this is, you know, the third market that's out there. You have the Dow, you have the NASDAQ, and then you have this. So
maybe. I think the SEC is going to be all over this. This is going to be, if not completely killed or tried to be killed by the SEC, all the money of all of the traders is going to be against this because they all have their hand in the pot, right? Now, that's not to say, like, I think you're right about Overstock.com. If there's a very short list of companies or entities that would be able to put enough weight behind this to actually make it happen.
Right.
And I think it's taken the past 5 years of sort of Bitcoin's growth and success to get to a point where a company like Overstock.com is willing to put their power and their money where their mouth is and start working on building this. We can have all of the technological solutions that we want, but they don't matter until someone starts using them and puts energy behind them. You can have the cure to cancer, you can have room temperature nuclear fusion, which recently apparently has been validated by a third party, maybe.
I heard that was a little bit of conjecture.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you can have room temperature nuclear fusion. You can have the cure to cancer. You can have the cure to Ebola. You can have all this shit, but it doesn't matter unless you can actually get it out to market and get it in use.
Yeah, I think Overstock is, you know, they definitely get some credit in terms of going up to bat to build this, but At the end of the day, I mean, if this works out for them, that puts them way above the market in terms of just all the feature sets that come with adding cryptocurrency and, you know, these equity platforms. So they're definitely taking a risk, but it kind of seems maybe an all or nothing. This could go really, really well for them or really, really badly.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean,
yeah, I think it's going to end up not very good. I think everyone else said pretty much what I was feeling. The SEC will be all over this. I'm surprised they're not already. So,
well, I think the other thing you have to look at is Overstock and these people building these platforms. No, it's not like it's going to be a surprise. They're like yeah. Oh, the SEC. No, like they're actively knowing that these guys are watching every single, you know, move they're doing. You know, whether they had McDonald's for breakfast, yeah, or, you know, they had this particular discussion. So they know they're looking at what they're yeah, doing.
Well, I mean,
I think that's an important point.
You said it was going to be bad, though, if they, you know, it's either going to be really good or really bad. But I think it's either going to be really good or just nothing will happen. I mean, it's not going to be like they get burned for this. It's just that, you know, they're going to try and maybe they'll fail. But right, they aren't going to – it's not going to kill their company. You know, they might slow them down. They're gonna, yeah, you know, they're gonna spend some money on this. But yeah, you know, at worst they try and they fail. I mean, at best they try and they succeed very well.
I mean, look,
no one else has.
Look back 10 years. Like getting a company listed on an open exchange like this is no small feat, right? Overstock.com is a company that came out of the first internet bubble, right, in the 2000-2001 sort of like bubble. They've survived. They've been through this process before. They've talked to the regulators in the past. They've had to go through all the due diligence. They know the steps that are involved to do this. Sean, I think you're absolutely right when you said like this is one of the companies that would be capable of bringing this to market. So I'm really excited to see that. We're starting to see other exchanges sort of cropping up. Master Exchange, which apparently is either the first or a new colored coin exchange cropping up. I think we're starting to see a lot of other exchanges popping up, and I think it's going to be really important to let them compete with one another rather than have, you know, this monolithic set of, you know, just the Dow Jones, just the, you know, S&P, just, and there's several other, the Nikkei and all of these other exchanges that exist in other countries too. I'm really excited to see more of them crop up and force these centralized entities to compete.
Sean Wilkinson is the founder of Storge.io and Bitcoin developer. He was kind enough to join us today for the current topics segment of the show. Hey, Sean. Thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Awesome. So you're the lead developer and sort of the ideologue for Storge.io. Why don't you give us a quick overview of what Storge is and why it matters?
Sure. So there's two parts to Storge. One is to be a open source protocol that allows people to essentially share their files and store their files on a decentralized network. So you can take your files, they're split up, and they're distributed throughout this network where only you control the keys to that data. So not like Dropbox or Google Drive, where a company is supposed to be a good steward of your data. We see that hasn't happened as of recently. I think the other day there was a third-party service that was compromised with Dropbox, and a lot of people had their account information compromised. So we kind of want to give back control to the users. The other portion is that we need somewhere to put these bits of files, and so we allow users to sell their extra hard drive space to this network. And so it comes together in this great little collaborative cloud. And so that's what we're trying to really build.
Okay, excellent. So I want to talk a little bit about the Dropbox compromise. So Dropbox, I think, is the golden standard in sort of the masses' perspective on file storage and having easy synchronization across multiple devices. There's even, in sort of startup culture, there's the Dropbox demo moment where, you know, they did this little video and they moved a file into a folder and then pop, it magically appears on another machine, and it was utterly amazing. Talk to me a little bit about how you think the storage concept and why decentralization matters in light of this recent Dropbox hack.
So I think one of the first and one of the most important parts is security. So when Dropbox came out, you know, it was new and innovative in terms of its feature set. I can go, oh, I can put a file in a folder and it'll show up on everywhere, all my computers and my phone, and that's amazing. That never been done before. You had to go email it to yourself, or if you're techy enough to go set up an FTP server or whatnot. So for the average user, it was a great way of getting files around. But a lot has happened since then. The data itself has become more important in terms of the files we store. You got your bank information on there. You got your Bitcoin keys. Information has become very, very important to us as a society. And so it becomes more valuable to compromise and get that data and sell it or do what you may with that data. And the problem arises with we're using kind of an old model for data security, or no model at all, really. So you have a company that has some servers, and you take your files and you store them on those servers. Well, you have this essentially this large treasure trove of data. Think of it as you go in a cave and there's gleaming gold everywhere and jewelry and everywhere, and you hope that that dragon is going to protect you against getting all your data compromised or all that treasure trove of information. And it turns out once that information is valuable enough, someone will get in, someone will slip by, and someone will get that information. And so in that sense, the centralized structure of a data holding your data, a company holding your data, and trying to be a good steward of your data, it really doesn't work that well. And you can just look in the news. I mean, just look at, you know, Google hack or company hack, and you can see Dropbox, Snapchat, Target, all these major corporations is getting broken into every day. So this large treasure trove of information stuffing it in one place isn't really working. So in terms of building out a more decentralized aspect, you say, okay, instead of keeping it all in one place, all under one security model, all controlled by one person, let's instead take this information and give more direct control back to the users. So instead of just going on a central server, let's have the user encrypt their files or lock it up, and then you can put it on a provider or anywhere you want on the network. So if that's ever compromised in any way, well, they just get a bunch of lock boxes, essentially. They can't do anything with that information. And I think that's important in terms of returning the control of the actual data back to the users and only having the users have access to that information. And so whatever happens, compromise, whatnot, the users are the one that are not actually screwed over.
Yeah, excellent. So I think this takes sort of the central banking analogy as it's applied to the Bitcoin infrastructure and said, like, rather than creating, you know, a central company where there's a big target, right? Like, if you hack into the central server, you know, you could get all of these people's data or all of these people's money if you're going to a bank and robbing the bank. Do you view this as being the correct way forward, and do you think that decentralized file storage will solve the centralized hacking problem in terms of incentives?
I do. I mean, there's always edge cases where if you stick your password on a sticky note and put it on the front of your computer, then you're probably going to get compromised.
Right.
But at the end of the day, that's your fault. We want to move it more from a way you're not doing anything wrong, and suddenly all your files are compromised. I think security is the first portion, but there's a lot more features that we can add on to that. One is privacy, since you're not going through any kind of central authority. No one is able to essentially kind of look at those files and try to figure out what's going on. Three is kind of cost. So once you essentially level the playing field where I'm just paying you to store these bits of data, well, then you can have a lot of more people enter the market. So if I'm going with Dropbox or any of these other companies, well, what does Dropbox have to cover in their core costs? Well, they have to cover their employees, the insurance, the investor profits, the heating and cooling, maintenance for the servers, the servers themselves. All those things factor in the core costs. Whereas you have someone who's a participant in a network, well, they just download a piece of software, hit go, and they're part of the network, and they're contributing. So in terms of that, we've eliminated all those costs. And if you actually look at the numbers of some of these providers, they end up charging anywhere from 10 to 100x their core costs because they have to cover some things, but also in terms of, you know, getting a lot of profit out of that. So when you essentially decentralize it, you take care of all that middleman, you take care of all those cost structures that were in there, and things end up being a lot more cheaper, or the users offering the service get a lot of money, and they're quite happy by that.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that really struck me when we first talked at the Texas Bitcoin conference about storage was the cost basis. I think your white paper suggests that you can cut costs by some – what's the factor of cost cutting?
The Dropbox and Google Drives of the world are kind of adjusting their pricing models right now. So our numbers are anywhere from like 10 to 100x, but they seem to be adjusting right now to compete with each other. So I'll give you an example. I was reading up about EMC the other day through some of their papers, and essentially they charge about, from what I read, about $3,000 a terabyte. Well, you can go to your local Best Buy and pick up a 2-terabyte drive for like $60. So the cost disparities is huge in this amount. So one, we want to be able to build out a network that kind of saturates this huge $150 billion industry of cloud computing and cloud storage. But then I think as that grows, we'll start to drive down the cost where you can't essentially charge these huge overages because some guy down the street is going to say, oh, I can make thousands of dollars off one hard drive. You know, I'll charge half of what you're charging. So people will kind of start to migrate that way. And then we'll start to bring the cost down. And that allows people to do really cool things once they have a lot more data to handle at a lot cheaper costs.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the reasons, like, I think EMC is able to charge the $3,000 that they do is because you're not just buying the pure storage. You're simultaneously buying, if you think about this in abstract ways, you're buying a rated storage, right? You know, they might be buying 3x that storage, so you know if one of those locations fails, you know, they have a fallback. Sure. What you're also buying into, I think, is the trust in the name EMC and the reputation that, you know, the general population is going to believe that they're going to protect your data. And as you and I both know, we believe in decentralization over centralization and that it's more safe to have it decentralized. How do you view the psychology, and how do you think that the general public is going to transition into a decentralized model? Or do you imagine more centralized, just more distributed individuals popping up in this space? Will there be more competition, and how will the psychology be impacted?
Sure, sure. So, yeah, there's definitely a psychological aspect to it. I mean, there's an old saying, you know, back in the day, no one got fired for essentially hiring or buying IBM products. So it's the same thing for EMC. No one got fired for using EMC. So essentially what you have to start doing is one of the things we're doing as part of storage is we have a kind of corporate entity that we're building. So it's called Storage Labs, and essentially what that's doing is taking the open source protocol stuff, cleaning it up, and then pushing it out to enterprise customers and consumers. So in terms of that, a company that might want to use a storage network that says, hey, it's more cost effective, it's more secure and private, but we don't understand or care about all this Bitcoin mumbo jumbo blockchain stuff. Well, then essentially we can offer a more corporate service to them to essentially provide all the tools and APIs to make that easy for them. So we kind of see that as an entity as bringing people into the storage network. Instead of dealing with all this open source software, you can deal with a trust in a company if you want to go that route, whereas regular developers can essentially go through the open source network. So we kind of see that duality as the best way to do it, the best way to onboard the majority of corporations and whatnot who would love to use this software because they can see the feature sets. We can start offering, in terms of guarantees of privacy and security, that a centralized company, even EMC, can't necessarily offer. I'll give you one example. So you might be paying for, you know, 3x redundancy, right? So that's the recommended portion that we have for storage. But essentially, we have a distributed peer-to-peer network where users are able to control all the variables for the data. So essentially, if you had something really, really important, you could have level 500 levels of redundancy. So that'll protect you against Armageddon and acts of God, pretty much. So we, in terms of getting it out there and getting people to use it and getting away from these centralized companies, I think we can sell it on feature sets alone. So in terms of costs, privacy, security, we'll just say,
here's our breakdown, here's their breakdown. You can see there's like night and day, there's a huge difference.
Yeah, so it's sort of similar to the Red Hat model, where you have an open source product that you're basically giving away and saying, hey, you can, you know, run this on your own. But then you're developing services and support up on top of that with your name as your as the thing that you're selling and the trust in you as an organization. Is there an opportunity for other individuals to sort of build and optimize those storage devices and perhaps provide them at a more optimal cost to the network?
Yeah, so one thing we're real heavy on is people taking the storage code base and taking the storage architecture and essentially white labeling it to do whatever they want. As long as they're building some kind of application on top of the storage network, well, they're consuming data and they're help building the network. So, you know, we're happy for any company or any organization or any group of hackers, coders that take the code and the network and use it. Right. And everyone gains as a benefit.
Excellent. What do you think are some of the challenges, the biggest challenges that you're going to face in transitioning from the centralized model to a decentralized model, specifically in the context of storage?
Sure. Well, in terms of the challenges, there's definitely the kind of regulatory aspect. The regulators are still trying to figure out what Bitcoin is, so it's hard to now describe to them, oh, yes, we have, you know, like three steps ahead now. Now we have decentralized applications and all these tokens and whatnot, and there's confusion whether these are, you know, like assets or they're equity, or there's so much confusion in that space that it really takes a lot of time to make sure you're compliant and make sure you're doing everything right. But there's no precedence. There's no way to say, like, oh, this is what you should do, and like, okay, we'll follow those rules. It's just like it's just kind of up in the air how to work those things.
So is there any existing regulatory frameworks for file storage? I'm not aware of any, personally.
No. I mean, we think we're in a little bit of better boat because essentially we're offering a data service just like Dropbox or Google Drive or any of these other services. But it's still kind of up in the air, and so we're trying to be very careful in terms of the way we approach this on the legal side.
Is there like a terms of service or a sort of an SLA of sorts where you say if, you know, you're using storage, we guarantee X, or are there just simply no guarantees? How are you managing sort of user expectations and sort of, well, you know, who do I sue when I lose my data, right?
Right. So we're going to be working very closely with our lawyers to essentially get some nice legal terms
sure.
on there. But at the end of the day, it's an open source network run by the users.
Excellent.
So, well, it's your guarantees with typical open source software. In terms of the guarantees, well, if someone was obviously a part of like customer storage labs, then that
sure.
would be that would look differently. But we're fairly confident in terms of our networks and building things out.
Excellent. So, Riddle, what do you think about sort of the Red Hat model and how it's applying to more and more situations? I know you're from the Raleigh-Durham area, so you know Red Hat pretty well.
Yeah, at least with like this model, one of the biggest hurdles I'm gonna say is that is locally stored credentials. I think that rather than people targeting like the centralized institutions, they're gonna start going for the malware side of things. Now that people aren't storing things in a centralized form, they're gonna start targeting the users themselves instead. Stealing their wallet dat files like has started to pop up in those kinds of things, or potentially stealing storage keys. I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with your product to know.
Sure. So you're definitely right. So if you have the centralized caches starting to disappear, essentially what you would have is the malware, the hackers, whatnot of the day. They would transition to where the data is. So I think it's important we're exploring some areas in terms of, okay, how do we address that? And I think the prevailing answer is hardware-based keys. So don't essentially keep all your private keys on your computer and software because anything can access that.
Yeah, air gap.
Right, exactly. So if we start managing those keys through hardware, then we start to solve those problems. So there's a lot of hardware devices already built in on some Intel chips, and we also see external devices like the Trezor for Bitcoin. Yeah, exactly. So I think that's the way to go. Then you start to solve a lot of those malware problems where you physically have to push a button for something to happen. Yeah, I think that's where we're going.
I really feel like that's probably the biggest hurdle that Bitcoin and other decentralized software has to go through right now, specifically because the main reason people use centralized systems is because they trust them to be smarter than themselves.
Right.
People use things like Gmail because setting up their own mail service is complicated, and they don't want to have to worry about the latest security patches. They don't have to do all that. So as soon as decentralized stuff can prove that it is more secure than the centralized solutions, the centralized solutions are going to die very quickly.
Right. I think the most important part is abstraction. So at the end of the day, you're going to get in your car, you're going to turn the keys, you put it in drive, and hit the gas pedal. You don't care about what's going on underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had to think about that all to start the car, you wouldn't go anywhere. So abstraction is a very important point of making things work and making our world work. So people are like, okay, I'll use Gmail because it works and I don't have to worry about anything else. And so in terms of building out our products and services, we've thought about that very much in terms of in the initial days, we want to essentially push this out to Bitcoin users and get them using it and getting them play with it. They understand some of the crypto stuff behind it, all the cryptocurrency and the blockchain stuff. But we really want to push it to end users as well. And in terms of that, it's using abstraction. So you have a service or an application where people drag and drop their files, and it syncs and it works. But they don't necessarily know or care that we're using the blockchain and all this peer-to-peer stuff and cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. They don't care. And so you really wanted to get at the point where it just works. And so I think in terms of Bitcoin, we're trying to get there. It's hard to get there just because of all the cryptographic primitives that you have to understand just to use it in terms of public key, private key, all that kind of stuff. But I think we're getting there, and I think people are understanding it, and people are paying more attention to UI and all those other stuff that goes with actually using this stuff. But it's going to take time.
Yeah. I mean, if you look back in time and look at things even like ATM cards, like credit cards and things like that, there was a lot of marketing that it took from those companies to get people to use them because they didn't trust, because they couldn't see the money anymore because it was invisible. It was on this little card, and people didn't really trust them, and it took a while. And I mean, now they're wildly popular, but until you got that, like, people understanding how it works, it was more of a fear of the unknown. And knowing I know my dollars are worth something,
right?
And I think as it's mostly more a concept of time. It's going to take people to kind of get used to it being there, not it being a new fad, because people are also afraid of it being the next new fad and it dying.
Right.
So once we got through the entire full early adopter stage, then we'll see things like storage and Bitcoin just completely skyrocket beyond what I believe people are really expecting them to do.
Beyond the moon?
Yeah.
To Mars and Jupiter and beyond, right?
Andromeda.
Yeah, exactly. So you talk a little bit about the real early adopter curve, right? Like, how far into sort of this cryptocurrency decentralized movement do you think we are at this point?
I mean, we're getting to the point where we're seeing more pop culture references to it, which is kind of a good point.
Like The Simpsons, right? The Simpsons just featured Bitcoin in their introduction this season, right?
I hadn't seen that.
I think in terms of adoption and getting things out there, I think in terms of using Bitcoin, I don't think it will be like actually putting the name Bitcoin out there. I think in terms of getting mainstream adoption, will just be products and services that use Bitcoin on their underlying technologies. Let's say remittances, right? So you have Western Union charges 8% fees, and I want to get my money from one area to another, whereas I can use Bitcoin as an intermediary and pay like 1%.
Yeah.
So I think that's maybe the way future before, you know, Bitcoin gets to the moon or whatnot, is in terms of those underlying products and services that people don't necessarily have to worry about Bitcoin, but and provide value to the network.
Yeah, so I've long said that, you know, Bitcoin will be mainstream when it becomes invisible. How do you think that that applies to storage and decentralized storage in general? Do you think that maybe the killer app of decentralized storage isn't the Dropbox clone where I can now have a place to put my files? Or instead, maybe it's just the underlying replacement for the disk, perhaps, on local computers?
Yeah, so we think of storage more as an underlying platform than just particularly decentralized Dropbox. A lot of people peg storage to decentralized Dropbox. That's just one of the applications that we're kind of building out. So we really see it in terms of a data storage platform that uses this technology on the back end, but at the end of the day, you can have a company or a user that goes to a website or interface, an application, pays in dollars, stores their files on there, and has no mention or any interaction with cryptocurrency, because that's how you get it to mainstream.
Yeah, users.
So
absolutely.
That might be happening on the back end. Bitcoin users might have, you know, their own native applications where they can essentially use Bitcoin or whatnot, but the average user is going to use it as a data protocol and not really even know it's there.
Okay, excellent. So fast forward 10 years. What is your vision for where storage is at in one decade?
Well, I think the in terms of data storage online, in terms of these networks, I think the obvious next step is decentralization. Just because you have, you know, any other provider like, you know, Amazon EC3 or whatnot, and they have a switch failure and they take out a quarter of the internet with them. And so all those people are like, hey, we lost all this money. Or you have a company that has their files on one of these services, Dropbox, it gets hacked, they lose customer data, they lose a lot of money from that. And so you have all these recurring themes. It's like, okay, where is our exit? Where is our next step? So I think they'll start to look at platforms like storage for those solutions. And so we'll get in terms of, I think 10 years from now, just centralized providers will either just be a part of the network or completely gone away. You'll buy your resources in terms of storage, compute, and whatnot from the internet, from the network at large. And it'll be cheaper, faster, and it'll work, and it won't necessarily go down. I think one of the most important points is you look at something like the Bitcoin blockchain. How long has that gone down for the past 5 years? You have any numbers?
Yeah. I mean, at most, there was a fork at one point, and that's like, not even downtime. That's just multiple networks now instead of one.
Partition. It's back to the cap theory. Yeah.
But that was resolved fairly quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
So what, three, 4 hours for 5 years?
Yeah.
That's pretty good uptime to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's just kind of the obvious next step. And then we'll get into really cool stuff in terms of decentralized computing and It's just the next step.
Okay, so talk about decentralized compute. I mean, we're all following the Ethereum project pretty closely. There's a number of decentralized compute tools being put out there at this point. Is there an order of events for this sort of vision of the entire decentralized future? So we obviously, I mean, decentralization existed long before Bitcoin. But Bitcoin really has brought decentralization to finance and has disintermediated the banks and Western Union and all of this. Now we're talking about storage and we're talking about compute. What is the order of events that this sort of great decentralized future that we all sort of dream about, what is it? What does that look like?
Well, it's funny to kind of go back and take a look at our history in terms of Bitcoin. You have essentially these opcodes or whatnot in the actual Bitcoin core software that would allow you to do like this Turing complete programming languages in a blockchain and be able to do all these contracts and whatnot very early on in Bitcoin. And then it was kind of decided, wait a minute, this might not work, or this everything else in the Bitcoin software up to this point will work, but this might break it. So the developers chose to kind of remove those or disable those. It was a very, very hard problem in terms of how do you get compute, how do you get
Turing completeness in a blockchain. And so now, several years later, all the rest of it is solid, and we're kind of taking another stab at it with all these different platforms in terms of smart contracts and Ethereum. And there's a lot of excitement from that. People understand how cool and how game-changing to be able to have an enforceable contract on a blockchain, on this decentralized network that you don't need a court or whatnot to mediate. And so a lot of people are excited. You saw how much money Ethereum raised in terms of those offerings. But no, we're starting very small. There's still a lot of work to be done on that. So ideally, we want decentralized compute on a blockchain or some kind of decentralized network. But the computer science behind that is really, really just kind of figuring out. So Bitcoin kind of opened the door in terms of solving the Byzantine generals problem and all these computer science problems that you have to solve to get to a decentralized computing network. So we got up to the point where we can sync a public ledger amongst millions of nodes, but in terms of now processing information, that's a very hard problem. So you have something with like Ethereum, which is starting to get away there, but there's still a lot of open-ended questions. How do you do that on the computer science side? And if you ask the computer scientists, we're just like, we really don't know. Because if you look at Bitcoin, for example, you have 10-minute blocks, right? So in terms of that, that would essentially, if I was using Bitcoin as an example, it would take me 10 minutes to essentially send a transaction query and then get that information back. That's way too long for any kind of usable application. And so there's a lot of stuff that needs to happen on the blockchain technology in terms of moving it forward for us to get to that point. And how we do that is an open-ended question. And people have a lot of money and are spending a lot of time in terms of doing that. So how do you do it? I don't know. There's a bunch of white papers you can read, but no one's solved it yet. So we'll see.
And we'll include as many of those white papers as you would like to reference in the links to the podcast.
Perhaps that's where Satoshi went. Yeah. He's working on that next step. So he'll come back and just say, I've solved it, guys. Okay, I'll see you again in another decade.
Our savior will return.
Okay, so if the community, if there's a developer out there or someone who knows marketing or business, how can the general population sort of help with storage and maybe even decentralized networks in general?
Sure. So all our stuff is open source on GitHub. That's github.com/storj. You can get in contact with us at hello@storj.io, so storj.io. And so we really place a lot of faith in the community. That's essentially the people who are supporting us, give us funds through CrowdSale to make this happen, developing applications. So if anyone would love to get involved, we'll find a place for you. We'll find stuff for you to do. None of this would have been possible without the support of the community, either directly building parts of storage or helping out in terms of the ideas and the marketing. And it's really the community that's the support behind this. So I might be, a developer, a lead developer in the storage applications, but none of this would have been possible without them. So we really love when people get involved in terms of just picking in our ideas or writing code. So you can just get in contact with us via email, hello@storj.io, and we'll find something for you to do.
Okay, awesome. It's 100% open source? Everything you do is in the open?
Yes.
That's fantastic. 100%. I love that.
I mean, it's a lot of people like to be maybe secret, or before there was an idea you want to be secret with your code, someone's going to steal it and create the next Facebook, but really find that doesn't happen as much. You put your code out there, people are able to look through it, they're able to give you great ideas and fix things up. So I told you this story before in terms of building out one of the portions of storage in terms of a front-end application. We hired a freelancer to do this, and he got paid, and he did the job, and it worked all right. Then we had a community member come in, completely redo the whole thing, and it's beautiful now. It works great. It works 10 times better than the guy that we hired to do this. So
It's really about getting that open source community involved, getting those developers involved that, hey, they might not be able to do full time or all this kind of stuff that some of we do, but they can take a look and say, oh, I can fix that bug, or oh, I can add that feature, or oh, I can make that 10 times better. Just spend a little bit of time on it. It makes the whole network better. And then people can start to build their own applications for their own uses, for their own business. So they just use storage as a platform. They can build all kind of cool stuff. So we have demos in terms of decentralized video, audio, and images that all run off of our prototype network and prototype API. So it's really, really cool stuff that the users just built. One of the coolest demos was, I think, the video demo. So we did a little contest, and we're like, hey, make an app after off of or some prototype APIs. And like 10 hours later, somebody came back with just like a decentralized video player running off our software. And I'm just like, oh, that's so cool. So users are awesome.
Yeah, excellent. So that's storage.io. I'm here with Sean Wilkinson. By the way, fantastic job. You and your team have put together an amazing product. Really looking forward to seeing what you guys put together over the next few months and getting more stuff out the door.
Indeed.
Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And with that, we'll wrap up this week's episode. We'd like to thank our special guest, Sean Wilkinson, and guest host, Rob Riddle. Thanks for joining us.